22-year-old Carla Vicentini was excited for her trip to America from her native Brazil. For months, she had saved up to be fully prepared as she would arrive in New Jersey on a 5-month work visa to continue her exploration into the field of textile engineering. Unfortunately, Carla would vanish just weeks into her visit. After arriving in New Jersey, Carla was unhappy with the job and living arrangements her exchange agency had made. After speaking with her parents, a client of her father's happened to have an apartment in Newark. He offered to allow Carla and her friend to stay with him for a while. Just 3 days later, she would vanish. Carla didn't speak English very well, and on the night of her disappearance, she was intoxicated and was seen in the company of an unknown man. Carla told her friend she was going out to look at something in the man's car, and then she was never seen again. Limited media coverage and a lack of clues has made Carla's disappearance an increasingly frustrating case for both her family and investigators. The question remains, is Carla still out there somewhere, or has the truth of her disappearance taken a darker turn? This is Trace Evidence, episode 108, The Disappearance of Carla Vicentini. Welcome to Trace Evidence. I'm your host, Stephen Pacheco. Today we examine the disappearance of 22-year-old Carla Vicentini. Before getting into the case, just a few notes about the show. Trace Evidence is a weekly true crime podcast focused on unsolved murders, disappearances, and other crimes. You can follow the show on social media on Twitter at TraceEvPod, Instagram at TraceEvidencePod, or by searching Facebook for Trace Evidence Podcast. The show is also on MeWe and Minds. If you're interested in supporting the show, as it is a one-man operation, and you'd like to get some Trace Evidence swag, there's a Patreon at patreon.com/traceevidence, or you can donate directly via PayPal. Visit trace-evidence.com for all social media links, donation options, and contact information, as well as thorough information on all episodes. To submit case suggestions, you can visit the website or email me directly at traceevidencepod@gmail.com. 22-year-old Carla Vicentini came to the United States looking for more, looking to develop her future, and instead got lost in the darkness. Before getting into the episode, I just want to preface it by saying I'm dealing with a lot of strange pronunciations here and translations, so excuse me if I pronounce some of this stuff incorrectly. This is episode 108, The Disappearance of Carla Vicentini. The United States is a popular destination for exchange students seeking to further their education. There are many draws for exchanges to the United States. According to the Institute of International Education, the number of exchange students in the country hit an all-time high during the 2018-19 school year, for the first time surpassing the 1 million student mark. There are many things that draw in exchange students, whether it's to sharpen up their English, experience a different culture, take classes not available in their home country, or just to expand their studies and be introduced to new ideas and different angles on critical thinking. In terms of nations of origin, China holds the highest percentage of the number of exchange students in the country. China is followed closely by India and South Korea. As you get down towards the bottom of the list in terms of exchange students in the U.S., Brazil represents approximately 9.8% of that number, meaning there are somewhere around 98,000 Brazilian exchange students. Of the 1 million who come to the States to advance their schooling, 51.6% are represented in the STEM fields, which is comprised of science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. Of those fields, engineering represents the largest percentage, that being 21.1%. 22-year-old Carla Vicentini was among those who came to the U.S. to pursue a future in engineering. Born on April 29, 1983, to parents Tonya and Orlando Vicentini, the oldest of three daughters, Carla was raised in Paraná. one of the 26 states of Brazil, with Paraná being located in the south of the country, two states up from the border of Uruguay. Carla grew up in a small agricultural town called Goiôra. Goiôra received its name from the first coffee farms that were established along the Goiôra River, with the English translation of the town being field of water. Goiôra is a large area with a small population, just under 30,000 residents in 564,000 square kilometers or 217,000 square miles. That is essentially the size of California and New York states combined. Just for comparison's sake, Goiôra has a population density of 51.3 per square kilometer, while California has one of 251.3 per square mile. There hasn't been much about Carla's case discussed in detail, and I'm unsure if this is due to translation issues or the fact that the American media put out extremely limited coverage of Carla's case, despite her disappearance having occurred in New Jersey. However, in her native Brazil, there have been countless articles and television specials discussing her case and the tragic mystery which surrounds it. There's been a lot of accusations that, being that Carla was not an American citizen, that the American media simply didn't find her case compelling. Portuguese is the official language of Brazil, and despite my Portuguese ancestry, I don't speak or read the language, I'm sad to say, so this was somewhat of a challenge. In a New York Times article, Carlos Kolbach, a reporter for the Brazilian paper Gazeta do Povo, the People's Gazette, explained that a lot of students come to the United States from Brazil, and while not all trips end well, Mr. Kolbach explains that many students find themselves deported, having stayed longer than their visa allows. Others have been incarcerated for various crimes or for overstaying their visas. One angle, which is much more rare, is a disappearance, and Kolbach explains, quote, "Disappearances are not so common. The story broke away from the typical he was deported, he was put in jail, she was legal," end quote. Carla has been described in various accounts as a smart, sweet, and shy young woman. The descriptor naive has been mentioned several times, with the young woman having perhaps a different view of the world, having grown up in such a small community, and ultimately dreaming of experiencing the lights and excitement of a major world city. There isn't a great deal of information available about Carla's background, though considering some of the statements made by her parents, she was a kind young woman who had a contagious laugh and was very focused on her future and her education. Carla's parents were hopeful about her dreams, heading towards the United States to experience the culture and attend a job. A sharp student, Carla would eventually find herself pursuing a degree in engineering. Carla arrived in the United States on January 19, 2006, having traveled through an exchange program. There are two different types of exchange programs in Brazil, those sponsored by the government and others which are privately owned and operated. As discussed in episode 60, The Murder of Karina Holmer, while the government-operated programs are extremely stringent and professional, some of the private operations tend to cut corners and bypass American laws to get exchange students into the country. As such, these private businesses tend to charge more exorbitant rates with almost a guarantee of getting into the U.S. This can make these programs dangerous, as those working to arrange the exchange are typically less concerned about the safety of their client and more interested in making money. However, this doesn't appear to be the case with Carla, who had a 5-month work visa and was in the country legally. The agency, World Study, which was used, is also considered a top agency in Brazil. While this eliminated the risk of arrest or deportation, it sadly provided no protection against someone seeking to abduct a young woman. Carla had been saving money for months prior to her arrival in the States, wanting to ensure that she had enough money not only for her trip, but to take care of herself, as while the exchange program provided students with jobs and access to education, the student was responsible for finding their own place to stay. Reports out of Brazil state that Carla knew others who had visited America, and she was extremely eager to see it for herself. In Carla's case, She was assigned to a job working at a White Castle fast food restaurant in Dover, New Jersey, approximately 28 miles to the west of Newark. At the time, Carla was staying at the Roxbury Circle Motel in the town of Ledgewood along Route 46. Dover is 4.8 miles to the east of Ledgewood, and while Carla worked there, I've never found much information about how she got to work. I assume she used public transportation, though later in the case it's revealed that she did know at least one person who had a car. Initially, Carla stayed at the motel with several other exchange students, but she wasn't exactly happy with the living arrangements. The motel is not exactly a five-star, with reviews on Google and TripAdvisor giving it a single star. One reviewer wrote, quote, "I think the sheets were clean and the shower was hot, but ew. The blinds had thick dust and grime on them and no curtains. Do not ever stay here, not even to save a few bucks. Scary." End quote. Carla's visa allowed her to work in the United States for a short period of time, and while arrangements were far from ideal, Carla was extremely excited to experience American culture. Her family threw a large going-away party for her, sadly not knowing that would be the last time they would ever see her. Frustrated with her situation, Carla and her new friend, Maria Eduarda Ribeiro, who she met at the Roxbury, began looking for a new place to stay and new jobs. Eduarda had come to America through the same exchange program. Carla phoned home to her parents daily, discussing with them what she was up to and how things were going. It was during one of these conversations that she mentioned the way things were at the hotel and her displeasure with the situation. Carla's father, Orlando, happened to know someone living in Newark, not far from where Carla was staying at the time. 70-year-old Jose Madera Martin Fernandez was a businessman who operated businesses in both Newark and Goyoere. Fernandez had an apartment in Newark and offered to let Carla and Eduarda stay in his living room. Both women were excited by the opportunity and quickly found jobs working at restaurants in Newark. Carla moved into the apartment on Saturday, February 4th. Eduarda joined on Monday, the 6th. Carla would vanish just 3 days later. According to Carla's mother, Tonya, in a federal Senate inquiry conducted in Brazil, the offer from Fernandez seemed kind at the time. Now, before I get into quotes from the official transcript, I should note some issues with the translation, and so my quotes will be as close to accurate as I can get them, adjusting for grammatical errors and misused words. Tonya explained Fernandez's pitch, saying, quote, "Your daughter, for me, is my daughter, too. I have this apartment in Newark, and Carla lives in Dover, a small town with little work possibilities. She can stay in my apartment, rent it by cleaning up, and she can share it with a friend." End quote. During her short time staying with Fernandez, things seemed to improve for Carla. Her calls home were much more hopeful and positive. Her family was happy to see that things were finally falling into place for the 22-year-old, and Carla herself was ecstatic. Eduarda got a waitressing job at the Adega Bar and Grill, located at 130 Ferry Street in Newark. Multiple articles have said that the apartment was also located on Ferry Street, though some have given the same address for Adega. While this is clearly inaccurate, I did find an official statement from Fernandez who acknowledged that his apartment was on Ferry Street. I only found two listings for a Jose Fernandez in the 70-plus age range in Newark, one formerly located on Jefferson Street and another on Lafayette Street. Obviously, neither of these is the Jose Fernandez connected to this case, and my inability to find a proper address may be connected to his move, which we'll discuss a little later. Carla herself got a job at the Mediterranean Manor, located at 255 Jefferson Street, approximately 9 blocks to the south of Adega, in the iron-bound section of the city, described as a large working-class community with a lot of ethnic diversity and a population of approximately 300,000, quite different from Carla's small town. However, data seems to show that there's a large population of Portuguese residents in that area, which would have made things a little more comfortable for Carla, who didn't speak very much English. On the day that Eduarda began working at Adega, February 9th, Carla decided to come down and visit her friend. It was a cold night in New Jersey and the snow was beginning to fall. According to reports, Carla arrived at Adega at approximately 10:30 p.m. Reportedly, at some point during the evening, Carla told Eduarda that she was going to walk down to their apartment and change clothes. This detail will cause some conflict later. When Carla returned, Eduarda noted that she'd been drinking and appeared intoxicated. It was around this time that Eduarda saw Carla speaking with an unidentified man who's been described as being in his 30s, standing approximately 5 feet 8 inches tall and weighing around 200 pounds. He had a light complexion with blue eyes, a beard, and short dark hair that was graying. Eduarda would later say, quote, "He was very strange. Everybody was jumping and dancing, and he was quiet. He had a strange face. He looked unhappy," end quote. Eduarda has also said in subsequent interviews that the man appeared distant, not behaving socially other than speaking with Carla. It was believed the man's name may have been Antonio and that he was buying Carla's drinks. Eduarda would later participate with the Newark police in helping develop a composite image of the unknown man. Eduarda was also confused about how Carla and the man were communicating. Carla spoke very little English, and according to Eduarda, the man didn't speak Portuguese at all. Eduarda felt odd about the man and tried to stick around Carla, but with how busy it was that night, she couldn't keep a close eye on her. Closing time for the bar was at 3 a.m., and sometime between 2:30 and 3, Carla approached Eduarda and explained that she was going to step outside with the man she'd been speaking to. According to reports, Carla said that the man was going to show her a picture in his car. Tonya would later state that the FBI told her that Carla had actually left the bar closer to 1:30 rather than 2:30. I don't know if it's a matter of a broken translation, though it does seem odd to be going to someone's car to see a picture. Eduarda has stated that she told Carla it wasn't a good idea, but Carla didn't listen and told her roommate that she would see her back at their apartment later that night. According to Porchlight International, Eduarda has also said that, before she left, Carla gave her a slip of paper with the man's cell phone number, but she lost it in the chaos of collecting money for the tabs started earlier in the night. Whether the number was real or not remains unknown. What we do know is that after leaving the bar that night, Carla would vanish. Strangely, Tonya would later tell the Brazilian Senate that Daniel Clegg, an FBI agent stationed in Brazil, explained to her that Carla had not been sitting and talking with anyone. In fact, he went on to explain that she was being very social that night and was reported to have been going around the bar talking to multiple people and laughing. Due to the international complexity of this case, the FBI has been heavily involved in the investigation since the beginning. There are some conflicting reports from witnesses later interviewed by police. Some witnesses claim to have seen Carla walking home alone in the direction of her apartment that night. Others reported seeing Carla getting into a car with an unknown male. Now, this is where the detail about Carla getting changed earlier in the evening comes into conflict. Authorities believe that Carla made it back to her apartment the night she disappeared, though they believe this occurred when she left the bar for the last time. They found a bag of her work clothing in the apartment. However, they also found her wallet, passport, and the jacket she was wearing when she left the bar that night, which seems to suggest that the bag of clothing may have been from earlier in the night, but her personal effects, which she had on her at the time, were also present, which would confirm that she did make it back after leaving the bar. A male friend of Carla's, though, claims that he drove her to Adega the night she disappeared and that she had her bag of clothes with her. The question which has lingered since that night is, did she arrive alone or was someone waiting at the apartment for her return? It was a cold and snowy night. It seems unlikely that Carla would have gone back out without her jacket. This is where the case gets even more mysterious. The next day, Eduarda went down to report Carla missing to the Newark Police Department. However, Fernandez would later say that he is the one who reported Carla missing. Another scenario, as explained by Tonya, was that no one reported Carla missing for 10 days. There's definitely a lot of contradictions in this case. Either way, after taking the report, authorities went down to the apartment. They found no signs of a struggle, nor did they find anything to suggest that Carla had been taken from the apartment against her will. Considering the items left behind, it was their belief at the time that Carla may have left the apartment of her own volition, possibly having come with someone else or having made plans to meet up with someone. When police went to Adega to review the surveillance video, they didn't find a trace of Carla or the man she was talking with. For Tonya, this was extremely difficult to believe. In an interview with Gazeta do Povo, Tonya expressed her frustration and made accusations against the owner of the bar, saying, quote, "It is impossible for my daughter not to appear. The police said that if a fly entered the bar, the cameras would capture it. This guy is lying and hiding something," end quote. Reportedly, the surveillance footage showed only the staff of the bar, and Tonya has argued that she believes the footage was tampered with. For the family, it was exceedingly heartbreaking as that footage was their one and only hope to discover more clues about what had happened to their daughter. In another twist to this story, several days after Carla disappeared, someone received a strange call. I say someone because I've read articles where this call was either made to her boss, to Fernandez, or to a friend of Carla's. Either way, the call's content certainly raised cause for concern. While the number that made this call has never been revealed, we do know that it originated in Honesdale, Pennsylvania, approximately 96 miles to the northwest of Newark. Allegedly, when the phone was answered, the caller screamed help before the call was disconnected. Now, there's also a report that someone called and said a woman was being held against her will in a hotel in Honesdale, but no further information was given by the caller. Fernandez allegedly told Carla's family that he had received multiple anonymous calls, during some of which he could hear a woman screaming and struggling in the background. However, despite Tonya's request for him to hand his phone over to police, he never did. Fernandez had been living in Newark for 42 years and told the family that he knew the city well and could help search for Carla, but he never did. I should note, police did go to Honesdale, but were unable to find anything connected to Carla. The Honesdale Borough Police reported that they had received a similar tip, though they were unsure if it was legitimate or a hoax. To make things even stranger, Carla apparently had a boyfriend named Tiago, who was in Rio de Janeiro at the time of her disappearance. In her statement to the Brazilian Senate, Tonya explained that 2 weeks after her daughter's disappearance, she had a phone conversation with Tiago. In this conversation, Tiago explained that he had received a call from Carla on Thursday, 2 nights before she disappeared. Reportedly, Carla was extremely upset and said that Fernandez had been sexually harassing her and making disturbing statements. Allegedly, Carla was so upset that she was crying on the call and Tiago wouldn't let her hang up until she calmed down. According to Tonya, Tiago said that Carla was so upset she had already started looking for a new apartment and was set to move out of Fernandez's on the Monday following her disappearance. This, of course, would kick off a lot of suspicions that Fernandez may have been involved in her disappearance, and by his actions, he didn't do much to convince the family otherwise. Just 4 days after Carla vanished, Fernandez returned to Brazil. According to the family, at no point did he try to contact them to discuss Carla or her disappearance. In fact, the first time Fernandez did discuss Carla was when he was called before the Brazilian Senate to testify. In his testimony, Fernandez claimed that he was asleep the night Carla vanished, but he heard her enter the apartment and leave again. The family found this suspicious since he told the New Jersey police that he didn't hear anything that night. Fernandez apparently also told police that he was awake at 4 a.m. when Eduarda arrived. He had to open the door for her as Carla had the key. Authorities later reported that Fernandez had returned to Brazil to finalize his divorce, but Tonya has said ever since he returned, he was avoiding her family, and according to Porchlight International, she believes he's lying, saying, quote, "We think he knows something more than he has said," end quote. Strangely, during the Senate inquiry, Fernandez seems to have a lot of animus towards the Vicentini family, saying that he wanted Tonya arrested and charged for all of the negative things she had said about him. He also laughed several times during his questioning, which I'm sure didn't help anyone believe he was completely innocent, but maybe it was just nervous laughter. He went on to say that he wanted nothing to do with the Vicentini family, saying that they impugned his character. While the translation isn't the greatest, Fernandez said, quote, "I don't even want to see the father, nor do I want to see the mother. She said that I assaulted her daughter, but I did not. She attacked my morals. I will never look at her face again, nor will I look at his face. I never forgive," end quote. Fernandez claims that Eduarda told him that Carla had gone out with two men. He also claimed to not have the password to his own cell phone, which is just bizarre, a phone which both Eduarda and Carla used. Fernandez said that his son, Leonardo, had helped Carla get her job at the Mediterranean Manor and that his son had returned to Brazil a day or two after Carla disappeared. Fernandez was then questioned about the two men he claims Carla was with the night she disappeared. He explained that she had arrived in a car driven by one of the men, though when asked if he gave this information to the FBI, he said he didn't. He would go on to suggest several times that he didn't believe Carla had disappeared and in fact accused her of running away to be with her boyfriend. The transcription ends with the suggestion that Eduarda should testify before them, though I could find no transcript of this testimony ever having been rendered. Carla's father also found the father of Eduarda to be distant. Orlando explained that he was given her father's number and called him to seek out information that maybe Eduarda had told him. According to Orlando, Eduarda's father was cold and seemed disinterested in discussing the case with him. Carla's family also reached out to the Brazilian consulate in New York, who said they would keep them updated about the investigation and wouldn't allow for it to be dismissed. However, after a few weeks, the consulate stopped calling with any updates or information at all. While Fernandez has gleaned a lot of attention from the family, the account of the unknown male seen with Carla that night is one that authorities have clung to. While they've been extremely tight-lipped about this case, they have listed the unknown man as a person of interest. There are some who believe this man may have abducted and murdered Carla, while others have argued that the man may have been involved in human trafficking and could have selected Carla as a target due to her naivete and her lack of English-speaking skills. When asked for comment on this, police elected not to speculate about the possibility. When Tonya was asked if Carla might still be alive out there somewhere, she responded, quote, "I don't think Carla is alive because she would never stay more than 2 days without contacting her family," end quote. Joan Petruski got involved in Carla's case and became a major point of contact for the Vicentini family. Petruski runs the Kristen Foundation, an organization designed to assist the families of missing people and named after Kristen Modafferi, who vanished from Charlotte, North Carolina in June of 1997. Tonya has described Petruski as her voice, arms, and heart in the United States. Petruski was able to get a billboard erected to bring public attention to Carla's case, though it seems no major tips have come in. Outside of the report of the unidentified man, there's been very little information garnered by investigators at all. A lot of this is chalked up to the lack of media coverage. In 2015, 9 years after Carla disappeared, the FBI offered a $20,000 reward for information leading to Carla's disappearance or the man she was last seen with. Carla's image was added to digital billboards throughout the state of New Jersey. In addition to the FBI's involvement, the Newark police have said the investigation is still active and being handled by their major crimes unit. Sadly, little has developed in this case, and for the Vizzantini family, thousands of miles away from where their daughter vanished, it's an incredibly difficult and trying time. When last seen, Carla Vizzantini was described as being a white female with blonde hair and blue eyes, standing approximately 5 feet 7 inches tall and weighing 130 to 140 pounds. Carla sometimes went by the nickname Carlina. She has several distinguishing marks and characteristics. She has a pierced tongue, a pierced navel, and wears multiple earrings. She has a previously fractured collarbone. Carla has three tattoos, a red and yellow chameleon on her hip, a tribal design on her lower back, and a dark gray angel with open wings on her back. At the time of her disappearance, Carla was wearing a white sleeveless shirt, a blue Hugo Boss jacket, jeans that were either blue or white, light brown high-heeled ankle boots, a silver ball in her navel, a silver stud in her tongue, a large silver ring on her ring finger, and two silver rope necklaces, one which had a pendant. She was last seen in the 100 block of Ferry Street in the Ironbound neighborhood of Newark, New Jersey. If alive today, Carla would be 36 years old, turning 37 next month. She's been missing now for 14 years and was 22 at the time of her disappearance. It's been hard for those who knew and loved Carla, and made even more so by the complete lack of evidence and clues regarding where she may have been taken. On April 29th of every year, Carla's birthday comes around, and for her mother, it's become too difficult to face that day. In an interview, Tonya explained, quote, "I told my family and friends, don't remind me it's her birthday. This month has a 28th and a 30th, but no 29th. I'll only remember that day when I have her back." True crime is my passion, but even I need the occasional break. So when I feel like I need a mental palate cleanser, my go-to refresher is Best Fiends. Best Fiends provides a fun and challenging series of puzzles that require strategy and planning, but remain fun and exciting. While Best Fiends has challenging puzzles, it's a casual game that anyone can play, even if it's made for adults. I'm always looking for something fun to keep my mind busy, and Best Fiend offers that and more. I've been playing for a few hours a day and have already reached level 40. I play a lot during my downtime. Best Fiend certainly makes slow moments in life pass by a lot quicker and with a lot more fun. I've even got my friends and family playing along with me. The colors are vibrant and pop right off your screen, the puzzles are enjoyable, and the cute little bug characters make funny sounds that make me laugh every time I hear them. In this game, you play against slugs, and so much fun to defeat them and level up your arsenal of bugs. You can even share your progress on social media, which inspires me to challenge and surpass my friends, making this 5-star game not just entertaining, but rewarding. Best Fiends updates monthly with new levels and events, so there's always something new to experience. What I really love is that it doesn't even need internet to be played, so when I'm on a plane or someplace where I can't connect, I can still play and have all the fun I have right on my own couch. I really enjoy unlocking new characters and leveling them up, seeing how the puzzles change and what new ways I can conquer the challenges. Engage your brain with fun puzzles and collect tons of cute characters. Trust me, with over 100 million downloads, this 5-star rated mobile puzzle game is a must play. You can download Best Fiends free on the Apple App Store or Google Play. That's Friends, but without the R. Best Fiends. I've totally become obsessed with playing Best Fiends, and it's such an enjoyable part of my day. Best Fiends has been downloaded over 100 million times, and I can totally see why. I used to play games on my phone all the time, but a lot of them became complicated or difficult to keep up with. Best Fiends provides a casual experience, play at your own pace, and you can come back to it any time. If you're looking for a fun, challenging, and rewarding game to play, I can't recommend Best Fiends any more highly. Download and play today, and maybe you can even challenge me. Download Best Fiends on the Apple App Store or Google Play today. The disappearance of Carla Vicentini is certainly a confusing one, to say the least. A young woman comes to a foreign country to expand her life experiences and her interest in engineering, and less than a month later, she disappears under what could only be called mysterious circumstances. You've got multiple accounts of what happened that night, contradictory statements about Carla's whereabouts and behaviors, and a lot of conflicting information about a phone call, which may or may not have been a legitimate plea for help. The man Carla stayed with, a friend of her father's, leaves town shortly after her disappearance and seems disinterested in cooperating. The friend Carla shared the apartment with has little to say since the beginning of the investigation and, in her own statements, contradicts what others have to say. At the center of it all is a mysterious man, the one last seen with Carla. Despite all of this, there's really only two major theories here, and there is a third, but it's essentially tied to the second theory. We begin with Jose Fernandez. According to interviews, Fernandez was a client of Carla's father, Orlando, who worked as an accountant. Fernandez was a French national who moved to Portugal as a child, then Brazil, and finally the United States, where he split his time living the other half in Carla's home state of Goiânia. When Carla was in the United States and unhappy with her living arrangements, Orlando spoke to Fernandez, who allowed Carla and her friend Eduarda to live with them while they looked for better jobs and arrangements. 3 days after moving in with Fernandez, Carla vanishes, and no one seems to have an idea of what could have happened, especially Fernandez, though Carla's family disagrees. Depending on which account you go with, Fernandez was either awake when Carla came home, or he was asleep and heard nothing. One statement he gave to the FBI, the other to the Brazilian Senate. Authorities do believe that Carla made it back to her apartment that night, though what happened afterwards is anyone's guess. If indeed Carla arrived at the apartment between 1:30 and 3 a.m., then there wasn't a lot of time for anything to happen in the apartment itself. Eduarda arrived back around 4 a.m., and she didn't report seeing anything out of the ordinary. According to Fernandez, he was asleep when Eduarda arrived, and he was awakened by her knocking on the door, at which time he let her in. Eduarda had given the key to the apartment to Carla earlier in the night, so she had no way in without someone letting her in. Sometime the next day, possibly around 12 p.m., Eduarda reports Carla missing, and Fernandez calls her parents to let them know what's going on. At the time, he says he'll try to help find her since he's lived in Newark for 42 years and knows the area really well. However, days later, he leaves New Jersey heading back to Brazil and does his best to avoid the Vicentini family. He doesn't give important information to authorities. He contradicts himself several times, and he fails to hand over his cell phone, on which he claims to have received strange calls in the days after Carla disappeared. When asked if he went to the police station to report Carla missing, he said that he didn't, that Eduarda had already done so, and he didn't think it was necessary for him to give a statement too. Of course, police later questioned him, and while the family's suspicions are aroused by his statements, local law enforcement doesn't seem overly interested in him. In fairness, the apartment didn't show any signs of a struggle, and this is an old, frail man in his 70s. However, that doesn't mean he's completely out of consideration for having been involved. We've certainly seen cases out there where an elderly person is able to pull off a crime against someone much younger, including, and perhaps especially, a highly intoxicated young woman. Reports estimated that Carla shared somewhere between $80 and $100 worth of liquor with her unknown companion that night. I suppose the question would be, what could Fernandez have done with Carla in the 1 to 2 hours he had before Eduarda came home? There aren't really a lot of options unless he was working with someone else. Now, I did read a few accounts in which Fernandez was accused of illegally helping people get from Brazil into the United States. However, I didn't find anything to confirm this. Though, if there is any legitimacy to it, He may have had connections to people who know how to smuggle someone both in and out of a particular location. There's been a lot of rumors that Carla may have been trafficked, and it's understandable why, but if you were in the business of helping people in and out of countries, you probably have your fingers in some pies that are shared by those who traffic people illegally. Again, much of that is speculation. It's truly hard to talk much about Fernandez. While his behavior is suspect, leaving the country days later, avoiding the family, not wanting to tell everything he knew to authorities, there's never been any evidence against him. One thing I found unsettling about him was, during his testimony in Brazil, he seemed to have a distaste for the two young women staying with him. He often said that they were spending time in bad areas. He said the Adega Bar and Grill was known for being a gathering site for bad people. It just seems almost like he's one of the older generation who didn't approve of young women living their lives the way they wanted to. In fact, when asked who he thought could be responsible, Fernandez suggested that it could have been someone Eduarda worked with or whoever helped her get that job. This is interesting only in so much as Tanya believed that the security footage from the bar had been edited and that the owner had something to hide. I've never found anything to verify that. Being that we know Carla vanished after leaving, it's hard to say what could possibly have happened inside that would need to be hidden from the camera, outside of the possibility of the owner knowing the assailant. All of that being said, this case remains confusing and disconcerting. Fernandez seems a particularly suspicious personality involved in this case, but ultimately, there's no connections made. If he was harassing Carla, as her boyfriend and mother claimed, that might suggest he could have had an inappropriate interest in the 22-year-old and may have made advances. Perhaps when she arrived home in a drunken state that night, he tried something and it went too far. Would that cause her to leave the apartment in a hurry, possibly leaving her jacket and belongings behind? However, that seems to stand in opposition to the state the apartment was found in. Again, we have this problem of how could he have done this in less than 2 hours? I suppose there are possibilities. I did find it interesting that his son, Leonardo, owned a construction business in the area. Honestly, though, I don't know what to say about Fernandez, but I'd love to know what you think. Before moving to the unknown male, I wanted to address these phantom phone calls. Now, several people claim to have received these calls, and all that can be said is that when answered, a female voice called for help. This is not the first case where we've had something like this. Whether or not the calls were legitimate, I couldn't say, but it's interesting that they originated in Pennsylvania. How would a random person there know the numbers of people connected to Carla in order to pull off an elaborate hoax? To me, the likelihood that these calls were real outweighs the possibility that they were faked. At the same time, there's a lot of confusion about who exactly received these calls. If it was only Fernandez, then I'd be a little more tempted to lean towards the possibility that these calls didn't happen at all. If we move away from Fernandez, that leaves us with the unknown male. Little's known about this guy other than a vague description and the fact that he was seen with Carla the night she vanished. I've never understood the whole story about going to look at a picture in her car. Some people have suggested that Carla may have actually been going to make out with the guy or hook up, and I suppose that's possible, but how did she end up back at her apartment, and why did she leave again without her jacket on a cold winter night in New Jersey? Again, so little of this case makes any sense. So, let's say for a moment that she did go out with this guy. Imagine he even drives her home, maybe she invites him inside. Some have speculated that the guy could have drugged her drink, either in the bar or at the apartment, and that he could have abducted her once she passed out or became unable to fight against him. That's not entirely out of the question. I've often wondered if perhaps the guy brought her to the apartment, waited downstairs in the car, and then Carla went back to talk to him or even take a ride somewhere. Maybe she forgot her jacket and just didn't want to go back and get it. I don't know. Maybe she was too drunk to do it. I mean, leaving your jacket behind doesn't make any sense to me, but considering she left her wallet and ID behind, who knows? Of course, We're dealing with a 22-year-old here, and as a former 22-year-old, I can say I made a lot of stupid decisions. If you factor in Carla's alleged naivete, I suppose that's a possibility. Her bag of work clothes was found in the apartment, so maybe she wanted to drop those off before continuing on elsewhere. The one issue I have with this is, if anything did happen in the apartment, why didn't Fernandez hear anything? He heard Eduarda looking to get let into the apartment later. You'd imagine that if there was anything weird going on, he'd have heard something, but honestly, it's hard to say. In his testimony, Fernandez frequently had people repeating their questions, as his hearing was apparently not so good, so maybe he wouldn't have heard anything. Or maybe he did hear something and was either too afraid to say it, or, sticking with his cold approach, chose not to say it, not wanting to be connected to it. It isn't unheard of for older folks to try and distance themselves from something they think could embarrass or impugn their character. It's also not out of the question that this guy, having seemed to not particularly like these two young women, may have felt on some level that she got what she deserved. I don't know if that's true or not, but it's just something that you can kind of read into his statements before the Brazil Senate. I'll post links to all of that on the website and you can read and interpret for yourself, but he just rubbed me the wrong way. We have witnesses who saw Carla walking home that night. We also have witnesses who saw her getting into a car. Strangely, there's no description of the car, nor is there an account of seeing the car actually driving away. Could this have been when she went out to supposedly see a picture? It's 2006. Who the hell is driving around with physical pictures in their car? Now, for a while, I entertained the possibility that maybe this was a mistranslation. Maybe this guy claimed to be some kind of an artist or something and wanted to show Carla some of his work. I don't really know. I can't even understand how they had this conversation with Carla not speaking much English and this guy apparently not speaking Portuguese at all. We heard this guy's name might have been Antonio, and while it's a name used in the Portuguese language, it's also used in other languages including Spanish and Italian. So I don't think that would predispose him to speaking Portuguese and maybe hiding it. And I imagine had he been speaking Portuguese, Eduarda would have noticed and told authorities. So is it possible, after all the twists and turns in this case, that it may be a matter of a random man grabbing a drunk young woman and abducting her? Sadly, that's certainly a possibility. If this guy was involved in her disappearance, there's really only two roads that are considered possibilities. Either Carla was trafficked, or Carla was murdered. Her family tends to believe the latter, and it's not difficult to understand why. There haven't been any sightings, although that may be more a result of the lack of coverage than the absence of sightings themselves. I spent a lot of time in last week's episode, The Disappearance of Lashaya Stein, discussing details and facts surrounding trafficking, so I don't want to inundate you with that same information again, but I would expand on it to say that approximately 14,000 to 18,000 individuals are trafficked into the United States every year. In a lot of cases, people visiting the U.S. on visas are trafficked by their employers who hold their passports or credentials, not allowing them to get away. We know that Carla's passport was left behind, but that doesn't mean she couldn't have been trafficked. Sadly, she's in the age range and at the time of her disappearance may have been unable to take care of herself. In one account, it was said that Carla was so drunk she fell down in the bar. Sure, that could be a sign of being drunk, but it could also be a sign of having been drugged. Carla's parents said that she drank, but she didn't drink to excess, so it's a question of whether or not this girl on her own in a foreign country was out partying, or if she didn't drink that much, but something was in her drink that made her seem drunk. There's the possibility that this began not as an abduction, but a date rape situation. That's certainly not a better scenario, but if Carla was drugged and taken away for sexual exploitation purposes, it's possible that things got out of hand and her abductor killed her when things went too far, but it's also possible that the entire plan was murder from the get-go. One thing which makes me believe the unknown male was likely involved in her disappearance is that the guy never presented himself to authorities. If he lived in the area, he would have seen something about the disappearance, even if it wasn't thoroughly addressed. If he played no role, why not come forward? Sure, he could have missed the news and never knew. Maybe he was too scared, but he could also have something to hide. The FBI and Newark police maintain that the unknown individual is a person of interest. They've never named anyone else a person of interest, nor have they suggested that they've been looking at anyone else as a possible suspect. While Eduarda reported that Carla left with one man, Fernandez said there may have been two. It's certainly possible that someone was in the unknown man's car or got into the car at a later point in time. We don't know for sure, but if two people were involved, it's certainly not difficult to imagine an abduction taking place. I wish there was more for me to say. I wish there was more to dissect here. I wish there was more evidence to go over or any real solid evidence at all. Unfortunately, there's just not a lot of information about this person of interest who I would wager knows more about this situation than we know. It's a hard thing to address a case where the evidence is so slim. It's especially challenging when there's been so little coverage. Reading through the Senate testimony is certainly enlightening in terms of background, but in the area of what happened that night, few, if any, questions were answered. So, what seems more likely to you? That an old man who may have been harassing his younger female tenant abducted her or did something to her, or that a mysterious man last seen with her was somehow involved in her disappearance? The last articles written about this case, at least in the United States, were in 2015 when the FBI announced the $20,000 reward. All has been quiet since then, though both the Newark police and the FBI say the case is still open and they're actively investigating it. One can only hope that they can finally find something to lead them to Carla, something to give to her parents in terms of an answer. For if they don't, this case will remain open, unsolved, and very cold. If you're looking for more information about the disappearance of Carla Vicentini, unfortunately, there's not a whole lot of it out there unless you have access to Brazilian newspapers. I will, of course, as always, post all the links on the website probably the day after this episode comes out. You can actually look into Carla's case on NCIC, where her case number is M93552581. She is also on NamUs under MP1244, and you can also find her on the Doe Network. If you have any information about the disappearance of Carla Vicentini, please contact the Newark Police Department at 973-733-6000. You can also contact the FBI field office in Newark, New Jersey at 973-792-3000, or you can contact the Consulate General of Brazil in Newark at 917-777-7777. What do you believe happened? Tweet me at TraceEvPod, email me at TraceEvidencePod@gmail.com, tag me on Instagram at TraceEvidencePod, or comment in the Facebook group. I've had a couple of people ask me about the availability of Trace Evidence merchandise. There's a couple of places you can go. You can go to traceevidence.threadless.com to see a wide selection of t-shirts and stickers and other items. You can also just go straight to the website trace-evidence.com and click the merch link in the header, which will provide you with links to places where all Trace Evidence merchandise is available. Did you know the True Crime Podcast Festival is taking place in Kansas City, Missouri this year? I'll be there representing Trace Evidence, along with hundreds of other true crime podcasters. If you visit truecrimepodcastfestival.com/trace, you'll receive 10% off your ticket. I had a really amazing time there last year, and I love meeting listeners, so I'd love to see you there this year. Remember, truecrimepodcastfestival.com/trace. Or simply use promo code TRACE at checkout. I feel like I would be remiss if I didn't address the international pandemic that's going on right now with the coronavirus. Times are very difficult at the moment. There's a lot of quarantining going on. There's a lot of being trapped in your homes, afraid to go out. The world can be a pretty dark place, so maybe use this opportunity to make some phone calls, call people that you care about, check in on them, just say hello. It's a good time to reconnect. We live in such a divisive world these days that when you're given the opportunity to reach out and reconnect or just speak to someone that you care about, you should certainly take it. Tomorrow, I'm doing a live stream in the Facebook group, and it's a good time to hang out and maybe blow off some steam, ask some questions, or just have some fun. And since we're all going to be trapped inside anyway, it's something to do. Depending how things go over the next few weeks, I'll probably pop up with some random live streams here and there just to connect with you guys, have some entertainment, and to save myself from going stir crazy inside of my house, which I rarely leave anyway, but for some reason when I can't leave it, I have this desperate need to get out. So watch my social media for those. I'll be announcing them, and maybe I'll do some live streams on social media accounts I don't normally do them on, like Twitter or Instagram. It's time to thank our Patreon producers. Special shout out to Tara Doble, Alicia Lorraine, Angie Dodd, Brittany Bivens, Brian Kemmerling, Roberta Jansen, Krista Colvin, Diane Dyson, Eamon Brady, Bacon Bits the Cat, Pamela Coburn, Abigail, Brett Eady, Kevin Bonham, Emily Smith, Emma Vachon, Gerard Lopez Barbosa, Jessica, Laura Dickinson, Linda Halcrow, Nick Mohar Schurz, Megan Cotter, Quinn McBreen, Randy Weiland, Robbie Blue, Tom Archer, and Tracy Woods. If you think your name should be on this list, but it's not, please contact me, as Patreon is often terrible at organizing the lists properly. I want to thank you for listening to this episode of Trace Evidence. I'm going to leave you today with a promo for a podcast hosted by two of my favorite people, a podcast many of you may know already, and if you don't, you should, a podcast called Moms and Murder. So thank you again for listening to this episode, and I hope you'll join me next week for another unsolved case on the next episode of Trace Evidence.
Hey guys, it's Melissa
and Mandy
with the Moms and Murder podcast. We're a true crime podcast that's sure to make you laugh without compromising the seriousness of the content.
Despite our name, we aren't just for the moms. Our show is for all the Diet Coke drinking, chicken loving, Dateline watching people in your life. Come for the murder and stay for the witty humor and pop culture references.
And you never know, you may even hear from some of your favorite names in the world of true crime, like Dateline's Josh Mankiewicz.
Do you have a preference on what we call you, Josh Mankiewicz, Manx, Sir Manx-a-Lot?
I don't hear Sir Manx-a-Lot quite as often as I...
I can make it happen for you.
Broken Homicide's Derek Lavasser.
Are you tearing up on me? I saw you waiting.
So beautiful, everything you're saying.
Or even America's sweetheart, Ally Sweeney.
The neighbor suggested that perhaps Kathleen had been attacked by... an owl.
The owl theory that Melissa and Ally Sweeney believe.
Again, so judgy.
Check out Moms and Murder anywhere podcasts are found.